May it please this court.
Yes, sir.
The people of Missouri today seek two rulings from this court, which I will address in turn. First, we ask this court to affirm the circuit court's ruling regarding our 2003 dispute. The circuit court properly declared and applied the law of vacator to find that the arbitration panel exceeded its powers to amend the MSA by substituting its own notion of economic justice and a pro-rata judgment reduction formula for the MSA's actual language that would have governed the allocation and reallocation of liability among the states. Second, we ask this court to reverse the circuit court's ruling regarding the arbitration of our 2004 dispute, because that ruling is contrary to the actual language of our MSA contract and to the controlling law and to these parties' course of conduct. Now, the 2003 dispute can be resolved completely by collaterally stopping the PMs from relitigating this same issue that they have fully and fairly litigated and lost in the highest courts to consider the issue of in Maryland and Pennsylvania. The PMs will tell you that there are two reasons why collateral estoppel shouldn't apply here, but both reasons fail. First, the PMs argue that the Pennsylvania and Maryland courts vacated the 2003 panel's partial settlement under state statutes that applied a different legal standard from the Federal Arbitration Act that we all agree applies here. The PMs are wrong. In Pennsylvania, the court said, under any standard of review, the panel exceeded its powers by acting beyond the material terms of the MSA. That quote is found at 114 Atlantic 3rd at page 65. In Maryland, the PMs admitted to that court that it could review for vacator under the state standard because the Maryland standard of review is equally or nearly as narrow as the FAA standard, and its application would not therefore lead to a different result. And so the Maryland court then found that yes, the Maryland statute is virtually identical in substance to the FAA. Those quotes are found at 123 Atlantic 3rd at pages 673 and 675. The second argument the PMs make against being collaterally estopped is that Missouri has somehow cherry-picked these final judgments from the courts in Pennsylvania and Maryland, and that there are inconsistent judgments that this court should consider from Colorado and from our own Court of Appeals. The PMs are wrong. Colorado was found diligent by the 2003 panel, and so it suffered no harm from that panel's excess of powers. And the trial court in Colorado said so when it dismissed Colorado's motion for vacator. But even so, that Colorado trial court acknowledged, quote, a real possibility in light of the settlement terms that a non-diligent, non-settling state could suffer a higher NPM adjustment penalty than it would if all states participated in the NPM process as contemplated by the MSA. That quote is found at page 1137 of your legal file. And of course, our Court of Appeals decision was vacated when this court accepted transfer. This identical issue, under the same legal standard, has been fully and fairly litigated on the merits by these PMs in the highest courts to consider it in both Pennsylvania and Maryland. The New Mexico trial court has also ruled in that state's favor. There are no other states who were found not diligent by the panel that are litigating this issue. The PMs should be collaterally estopped from asking this court to make Missouri the outlier among all the other states who were damaged by the 2003 panel's excess of powers. Now, the FAA and the related case law give us two additional reasons why this court should affirm the circuit court's modification of the panel's partial settlement. First, the 2003 panel exceeded its powers when it amended the MSA by construing Section 18J a section of the MSA that had never been submitted to its jurisdiction. And second, that panel again exceeded its powers when it imposed its own notion of economic justice to again amend the MSA, this time Section 9, so that now there are three categories of states under the MSA. We had two, we now have three, and we now have a judgment reduction formula instead of the MSA's express language for allocating and reallocating liability among the states. So FAA sections 10A, 3, and 4, which were cited specifically by the circuit court, and also the two-prong test set out by the United States Supreme Court, most recently in Oxford Health, that all provides the grounds for vacator or modification when a panel such as this one exceeded its powers as much as it did, frankly. First, under that two-prong test, we ask, were the sections that the panel construed within the area marked out for their consideration? Only if the answer to that question is yes do we even have to go to the second prong of that test and determine, okay, did the panel arguably construe those sections, however good, bad, or ugly? To find out the area that was submitted to the panel for its jurisdiction, we look at the MSA's arbitration clause. That is section 11C. We have set it out in entirety at page 13 of our opening brief. According to section 11C, the only disputes that ever go to arbitration are disputes over the calculations and determinations made by the independent auditor, happens to be PricewaterhouseCoopers. Now, there are 18 numbered sections in the MSA. Only two of those 18 numbered sections deal with calculations and determinations by the independent auditor. That would be section 9, which is titled Payments, and that's the section we're mostly talking about here today because it includes the diligence exemption, and also section 11, titled Calculation and Disbursement of Payments. Any dispute about any other of the 18 sections of the MSA is litigated. The panel's partial settlement fails the first prong of the Oxford Health test because it construed Section 18J. That is not Section 9, and that is not Section 11. And so 18J was never within the area marked out for the panel's consideration. 18J is the section that prohibits amendments unless they are unanimously approved in writing by every party who is in any way, and the key term is affected by the amendment. Missouri and the other states that didn't take this ideal strenuously objected to what the panel was considering doing, and we told them, you are about to do an unauthorized amendment to the MSA, and we are going to be affected by millions of dollars of greater liability. But the panel went ahead, and it construed Section 18J anyway to make it possible for the PMs and now 24 states to do their side deal. According to the panel, no state could prevent this amendment unless its rights were materially prejudiced. And then the panel summarily declared, hey, there's no evidence of material prejudice. So when the circuit court saw that, it described the breadth of the 2003 panel's overreach as clearly erroneous. The 2003 panel's partial settlement also fails the second prong of the Oxford Health test because the panel willfully abandoned even its interpretive role for MSA Section 9 when it created a third category of states. There were two, now there are three, and substituted a judgment reduction formula for the express MSA language that governed the allocation and reallocation of liability among the states. Under Section 9 of the MSA, states that are not determined to be diligent get hit twice. First, their payment is reduced by their own allocated share of the liability. Second, their payment is further reduced by a reallocated share of the liability that would have been borne by the states that were found diligent. MSA sections 9D to A, B, and C, that's where all this language is, and it's pretty lengthy. But in sum, subsection A mandates that the adjustment applies to every state except. And then section B says, states that are determined diligent do not bear allocation of liability. And section C is the key for us. Section C provides that all of the diligent states' shares are reallocated among, and the key language is, quote, all other states, end quote. That's at page 326 of your legal file. The MSA, therefore, plainly characterizes states as diligent or all other states, period. That second category is not states that have been found to be not diligent. Under the MSA, if a state is not determined to be diligent, it automatically falls into the second category.
So are you saying that the states involved in the term settlement then were non-diligent?
Under the MSA, they were all other states. The MSA has two categories. You're determined diligent, or you are an all other state. And if you are not determined diligent, you automatically fall into that second category. And every state that falls into the second category of all other states bears its full share of allocated and reallocated liability.
But the panel did not make any express determination on whether they were diligent or not diligent.
You're exactly right, Your Honor. They refused to. We begged them to. That's what they agreed to do. That's what this arbitration began as. We were supposed to come out of this arbitration with 51 determinations of diligence or not.
Well, how did the partial settlement prevent that determination from being made?
They left the courtroom. They walked away. And there were no hearings for those states. They simply left. And no one could bring them back. The panel created a third category of states whose diligence was unknown because the panel didn't determine their diligence. But they said, okay, for a state that whose diligence is unknown, we're not going to make them bear any share of reallocated liability. The panel ordered that reallocation of liability for the states that eventually did find diligent, the panel ordered that only the six states that were found not diligent would bear the entire burden of reallocated liability. And the panel directed, in that same partial settlement award, the panel directed the six of us to appeal to our circuit court for relief if we ended up finding out that somehow we had ended up with more liability than we should have borne. And indeed, that little two or three sentences where they directed us to the circuit court, that is the only edit the panel made to its partial settlement award, which had been drafted by the PMs and the states that took the deal. The panel's unauthorized amendments to the MSA shifted, therefore, $50 million of liability off of the 24 states whose diligence was unknown and shifted it on to Missouri. It's just that simple. We don't even argue about the number. The PMs don't like the way I describe how we got there, but we do not argue about the number of $50 million. The panel's partial settlement thus does not draw its essence from the contract, and it does simply reflect that arbitration panel's own notion of economic justice for some, but not all states.
But does the panel's decision or statement at the end of its award telling states that are upset by this decision, inviting them to go to their own MSA trial courts, does that affect then our state court standard of review away from our normal standard of review under arbitration awards?
No. No, we here in Missouri, I think there were some different arguments in other states, but we here in Missouri have always agreed that in order to vacate or modify an arbitral award under the FAA, we had to show that the panel exceeded its powers under 10A4 or under 10A3, that it engaged in some sort of misbehavior that prejudiced a party's rights. And those were the arguments we made. And that is indeed what the circuit court ruled. It cited both 10A3 and 10A4 of the FAA in length.
And we're not looking at any clearly erroneous standard at all?
No. No. The reference to clearly erroneous, as I was saying earlier, I believe was the court expressing its perhaps disbelief of how far away from its jurisdiction the panel had extended. I see that my time is up. I will take a seat unless there are more questions, and I'll come back and speak to you at rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming from Chicago, it's nice that for the first time in 108 years, I could be comfortable coming into Cardinal territory. The key from our perspective is the standard of review. Under the FAA, the standard of review is among the narrowest known to the law, and that's Missouri law as well, CPK cover. The language is even arguably construing or applying the contract. That's Oxford. Obviously, that means that it's just because one party thinks the construction is wrong. That doesn't mean there's an amendment. If you're construing the contract, you're construing the contract, even arguably, there's no grounds for reversal. However good, bad, or ugly. To be reversed, the arbitrator must be using their own notion of economic justice. But frankly, what I find even more important for our purposes is because in Garvey versus Major League Baseball, the Supreme Court said that even irrational findings are not reversible. There's no merits review. There's no review. In MISCO, United States Steelworkers, I think, the United States case, U.S. Supreme Court case, there was no reversal because the courts found there was no showing of fraud or dishonesty. And I want to put that into context over here. This is not a case where we often see in the consumer protection area where there's one arbitrator, not necessarily a lawyer, always being picked by one side, where the court is saying we need to look to make sure that there's nothing amiss going on, and we're going to check that out very carefully under the FAA. But what we're not going to do is we're not going to do a merits review. And who are we talking about here? That, to me, is the key. We're talking about three former federal judges, highly distinguished federal judges. Let me focus on Judge Mikva, because Judge Mikva was picked by the state. He actually served in all three branches of government. Former Democratic congressman, former D.C. circuit judge, former counsel to President Clinton. He ruled, together with the other two members, unanimously about this reallocation issue. There was also Judge Smith and Judge Fassler. Essentially, what the state is saying is that Judge Mikva abandoned his role as a neutral arbitrator, used his own sense of economic justice, decided to go against the state and agree with the tobacco companies. That's the only way the state reaches its decision, reaches its position. Essentially, to vacate the award, one has to find what no one has ever said about Judge Mikva. Let's put it that way. And I want to talk a little bit about merits review, because it sounds like, well, if it's irrational or if it's, you know, whatever the standard they say it is, well, that seems like a really high standard. But even if the standard is irrationality, as soon as you start doing a merits review, it starts becoming tough. Let's use an example. Irrationality is another way of saying that's crazy. But every single time, I'm sorry, maybe it's just me, you have conversations with people that you actually think you respect, but you walk away sometimes saying, boy, that was crazy. And what's the reason why? Is because it's such an easy step. As soon as you start doing a merits review, you're going to get into the easy step of saying, well, that was irrational. And so it's very important from the Supreme Court's perspective, especially in this context, where we're not talking about some consumer protection arbitration where you have all these other factors going on. We're talking about sophisticated parties, 46, 48, 52 states, and the tobacco companies, also sophisticated parties, agreeing to arbitrate in this type of manner with three former federal judges. I want to talk a little about collateral estoppel. Here there are conflicting decisions The state mentioned poo-pooed Colorado, but Colorado is another state that ruled expressly on this issue, saying that it was an appropriate finding by the panel on reallocation. Even though it might have disagreed with the decision, it said based on its standard of review that's required by the FAA, it must uphold that decision. The other important thing is that there are different standards of review. In Pennsylvania, the court standard was pursuant to Section 7302, D2 of the Pennsylvania statute. In Maryland, it was in violation of CJP 32224, B3. While they also mentioned that it would have applied under the FAA, that was dicta. And they actually, to the extent they were applying the FAA, they were using, in fact, even used the word rationality, Pennsylvania court did. And so that's the wrong, if they are applying the FAA, it's the wrong standard. If they're applying the state standard, that doesn't apply to here for collateral estoppel. So that's two reasons, but there's actually a third reason which we also mentioned why it shouldn't apply, and it's specific to the MSA. The MSA allows all 48 or 52 jurisdictions, their own state court, to rule on the issue. If collateral estoppel would be applied, you'd get the first decision, and that decision, if it went against the participating manufacturers, the fab companies, would then be used as collateral estoppel in all the other jurisdictions.
But even if collateral estoppel doesn't apply, why wouldn't they be somewhat persuasive?
No argument here. Of course it's persuasive, Your Honor. I mean, I don't think it's persuasive here, but to the extent it's persuasive authority, but we think they got it wrong. We think it's less persuasive here because they are applying the state standard in this situation. But as far, we're not arguing that this court should not be looking at those decisions, but we think they are distinguishable. And given what the standard is in Missouri, which as the state recognized is the FAA standard, that should be a reason why those cases are not controlling here.
But your opponent argues that Colorado is distinguished because in Colorado, Colorado was found to be diligent.
The state mentioned that's true, but that wasn't relevant. The court wasn't using it as a reason not to apply to it. It was still, Colorado still asked in that motion for a ruling on that issue. It didn't know whether it was going to be diligent at the time that it sought that ruling. So at that time, it didn't know. It eventually turned out to be diligent, and eventually turned out not to be relevant to it. But they did seek that ruling as a preliminary matter before there was a diligence ruling, as I recall. And at that time, the court upheld the reallocation provision. Pretty sure about that, Your Honor. If I'm wrong, I will let the court know. So we do have a split in authority, but it's especially important here where it's the MSA. And let me give a real-world example about how we know that it's so important. When it came to the arbitrability issue of 2003, the first court actually in New York actually ruled that it was not arbitrable. The states then said in Connecticut, oh, collateral estoppel. You're bound by collateral estoppel. Connecticut court, very important decision, ruled, I'm not going to be bound by collateral estoppel in a situation like this where the MSA gives each state court the right to do it. What happened eventually? What happened eventually was that 47 out of the 48 courts ruled differently than in the trial court in New York. Same thing happened in connection with the 2004 arbitration. This court wasn't involved in it, but there was an issue about who the arbitrator should be for the participating manufacturer. Again, the first court, in that case a different judge in Colorado, ruled one way. The state wanted to say collateral estoppel. The courts ruled, collateral estoppel was not applied. At the end of the day, nine out of the other courts ruled against Colorado. Only one other state, Iowa, ruled like Colorado. So it's not just a technical procedural point. In fact, it turns out that the first decisions are very often overwhelmingly found to be wrong by the other courts. And to be clear over here, it's not simply a question of the standard. The panel got it right. The MSA uses pro rata language. What does that mean? When there's an issue about allocation of the shares of the diligent states, what the MSA says is we're not going to impose all the burden on one state. We're not going to make any of the non-diligent states. We're not going to make diligence determinations as to the non-diligent state, which one deserves to get more of the reallocation. Instead, we will do it pro rata.
But isn't this common law reduction method contradictory to the MSA's reallocation provisions?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it's the better way of reading the MSA. Because what the MSA says in the context of where you have diligence dates where it needs to be reallocated, you use pro rata. That's the same thing we have over here, where we have states in which diligence was not determined. What do we do about it? Do we allocate all of it to those states, which is what the state would like? Do we allocate all of it to the non-diligent states, which we would have liked but we didn't argue? Or do you do something where you impose some but not all of the burden on both sides? That's pro rata. And that's the same theory that the MSA itself applies when the issue is allocation of diligent states. And you don't make the diligent determinations. That's what's important. The MSA never says you make diligent determinations to figure out how to do reallocation. And so the judgment reduction method is consistent with the MSA. It's the better way of reading the MSA. And just to make clear one point, at the time of the hearing, there was no state that affirmatively said we wanted to make diligence determinations. We want those states to come in to make diligence determinations. The panel specifically asked several times, what is your position? And they wouldn't take any other position except they should all be deemed non-diligent. They said some states felt this way, some states felt the other way. And it doesn't make sense to deem all of them non-diligent. And let me give a real-world example to that as well. New York. New York is 12% by allocable share. That is literally 20% of the signatory states. If they had settled before their diligence determinations, the state would have said, we better find them non-diligent, because they haven't had a diligence determination. And we can assume that most probably because they settled, they were not diligent. We actually know that's not true, because they were found diligent and settled afterwards. They settled after they were found diligent, but if they had not had that diligence determination, just like everything else, the state would have said they should be deemed non-diligent, and the PMs would have lost that reallocation amount of money. The state spends a lot of time on Puerto Rico, which is less than half the allocable share of Missouri. They spend a lot of time on Kansas, less than a quarter of the allocable share of Missouri. They don't spend a lot of time on California. California is also 12% allocable share. Combined with New York, you're talking about 40%. And there's a reason why they don't argue about California, because they can't point to anything in the record that would suggest that California would have been found non-diligent. But they said, but the state would like to have it all deemed non-diligent.
Now, was the state given an opportunity, or were any of the non-settling states given an opportunity to contest the diligence of the settling states after the settlement was entered into?
The panel asked what the position would be for the non-settling states, and none of them took the panel up on the making diligence determinations. So to the extent, if they had said, we want to do diligence determinations, the panel might as well have said yes. I don't know, but nobody from the states ever made that request.
But they were given the opportunity.
Yes, they were given the opportunity to at least ask I would divide it up into two parts. Part one is, what's the proper method of reallocation? If the proper method of reallocation is to do diligence determination, then they would have been given an opportunity. But they didn't even want to say that diligence determination was the proper method of reallocation. They were asked, do you think diligence determination is what you want to go, is the way you want to do it, which is called proportionate fault, where you look to the diligence of the settling state? The state did not say we want to do that. So there was never a time where the state said we want to do diligence determination and the panel said no. Does that answer the question?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I want to talk a little bit about the single state arbitration. There's three reasons why this should be a multi-state arbitration. First, the language of the MSA. Here, the MSA says very clearly the arbitration must be between two sides. What's the dispute here? The dispute here is over the application of the MPM adjustment, over which diligence is an important but only one component. In fact, even in connection with this arbitration, we're going to the 2004 arbitration, which has already started, let me put it. There's going to be issues that are of a more nationwide, multi-state, not just diligence for each of the 20, each of the states. So what's the, who are the two sides to that dispute? The PMs on one side, who believe the adjustment should be applied, and the states on the other side, who believe it should not. As such, pretty clear in the MSA, where the sides are the states and the PMs, you need to have a multi-state arbitration. And that's especially true here, given the structure of the MSA. We've been spending a lot of time about reallocation. Every state has an interest in the diligence of other states. Now, I think the state has said, well, we're not going to intervene, so we don't care about that.
Can the language, the references to two sides, be interpreted in more than one way, and does that make it ambiguous? And if it's ambiguous, then how should we consider it?
I actually think it cannot be read in more than one way. I think when it says two sides, you look at the dispute, and where the dispute is the NCAM adjustment, can't be read in more than one way. But I do think, to the extent there is any ambiguity, I think the Supreme Court law is very clear under the FAA. When you're trying to bring things into arbitration, it must be construed in favor of arbitrability. I think that's pretty established law, that you must construe in favor of arbitrability.
Here it's arbitrability, either way. So
it's fair enough.
Who is arbitrating, not whether it is arbitrated.
Fair enough, but I think in this situation where the arbitration would be a broader, that would be the better interpretation. But let me pause on that point, because I think one other way of looking at it is there's also other considerations that take into effect. There's the structure of the MSA, which to the extent there's an ambiguity, you look to the structure of the MSA. Here, the diligence of every state is relevant to every other state. If, as the state says, they're not going to intervene, it's still very important, because it's just as important to know what the standard is being applied. You want to have one standard being applied. You want to have one standard of what diligence means. You want to have one standard about how the statute should be enforced. You want to have one standard. If you have single state arbitrations in what could be 21 states, not for this arbitration, but for 2005, then you're going to have chaos. Beyond the point that you're going to have three arbitrators for each one, you're going to have different standards, and if there are interventions by states other than Missouri, you're going to have every state having multiple things. So besides the structure of the MSA, from a practical point, it really doesn't make sense to have single state arbitration.
And have single state arbitrations occurred elsewhere?
No. The only other court that has ruled is Montana out of the 48, but they ruled it wasn't arbitrable, so there it's in a state court. The issue is before a state court. Of every court that has ruled it's arbitrable and has addressed the issue of multi-state, every court has ruled that it's multi-state. But thank you, Your Honor, because that is going to be my next point. Every court that has decided whether it should be a single state or a multi-state arbitration, the case I would point to the most is West Virginia, has concluded that it should be a multi-state arbitration. Let me just touch on one last point, is that Missouri at this point seems to be arguing, they don't seem to be arguing the law as much. They seem to be arguing more from a, it's too late, there isn't any multi-state arbitration. And that's simply not so, Your Honor. I think we were able to file the reply brief and the motion we've taken under, our surreply of the motion was taken under advisement. But let's be clear, the term sheet states, the signatory states, they are never going to have an arbitration for 2004. There's going to be no arbitration for them, they've settled. As to the non-signatory states, or the non-settled states, we have currently an arbitration with 20 of them. There's only two states that aren't part of it, New Mexico, where we filed a motion to compel, and Missouri, where we are now in front of this court. But there's an arbitration going. They would be very surprised to hear, the four panelists, that there's nothing going on at this point, because we actually have a hearing again in December 1st. Everybody agrees to the neutral arbitrator, Judge Pro. Everybody agrees to the arbitrator for the states, Judge Robertson. There was a dispute which we resolved by having one arbitration where all four judges will appear, but they will be state-specific for state-specific issues, and they'll rule together for general issues. There are 15 states that have Judge Legg and 5 states who have Judge Birch. But there is one unified, integrated arbitration. So in short, our position is there is a multi-state arbitration going on, and Missouri should join those 20 states already in the arbitration, and we certainly hope that the remaining states will join as well. New Mexico, and I'm sorry, I forgot. There are 4 territories who I think together are less than 10% of Missouri's allocable share. We sent them a letter demanding arbitration. At some point, one of us is going to have to go to Guam to argue that motion. Thank you, Your Honor. Any questions?
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to answer 2 of Judge Russell's questions about the 2003 dispute, and then I'll turn to Judge Breckenridge's question about the 2004 dispute. Judge Russell asked if the common law judgment reduction method was contradictory to the MSA's allocation and reallocation of liability, and I would say yes, not only is it contradictory, but it was insufficient. At best, if we set aside the fact that it's an unauthorized amendment to the MSA, at best it only dealt with allocation of liability. At best, it only addressed the first hit of liability that those 24 states should have borne, their allocated liability. It took that off the table. What it failed to do, and the reason that Missouri continues to suffer, is that it did not address reallocation according to the MSA. It shifted all of the reallocated liability from the diligent states away from those 24 states that took the deal and put it onto Missouri to the tune of $50 million of extra liability. The second question Judge Russell asked about the 03 dispute was whether or not Missouri was given an opportunity to challenge the diligence of the 24 states that took the deal. The flat answer is no, unqualified, no. Mr. Liebenstein, I think, just confused a little bit. The panel gave the states the opportunity to argue about whether or not we liked its common law judgment reduction formula, which we argued vehemently against. But we were never given the opportunity to challenge the diligence of those states. Indeed, the state of Maryland spearheaded a briefing before the panel that was signed on to by many states. I can't remember who, but it would have been us too, saying, please let us challenge the diligence of those states, and the panel denied that motion. So no, there was never any opportunity to show that any of those states were not diligent.
Did Missouri do anything like Maryland did? Did you make any type of affirmative statement or objection?
At that point, our case had been closed for almost a year, and so we just signed on to the brief that Maryland drafted, but we were already out of the litigation and had been out for over a year. And so we did, yes, as of record, we are on record objecting, but I didn't go personally argue that motion. Now, Judge Breckenridge asked about the 2004 dispute, and you asked 2 really intuitive questions. You asked if the 2 sides to the dispute is ambiguous, and also whether or not there were any other court decisions that should persuade us here about single state arbitration. The straightforward answer on the law is that these parties agree they have an arbitration clause. They agree this dispute falls within the scope of that clause. Neither of us have argued there's any ambiguity there. And under this court's own precedent, Ellis in 2016 is the most recent case, the circuit court should have compelled the arbitration that we requested, just that simply. Under the Supreme Court law, which the circuit court did not cite, regarding the combination of parties or issues for arbitration, the Supreme Court, the circuit court failed to address that too, which goes to your second question, have any other courts addressed this single state issue? The answer to that is not since the Supreme Court ruled in 2010 in Stolt-Nielsen, except for only Maryland and Pennsylvania. West Virginia, Alabama, Georgia, all that, irrelevant. New York, irrelevant. All of those decisions were ruled prior to the Supreme Court telling all of us that no one can presume a party's consent to combined parties or issues in arbitration unless there is an express agreement. Our circuit court turned that precedent on its head and actually presumed that the consent existed, and that was wrong. The arbitration clause does only say two sides to the dispute. Side and dispute are not defined. By way of illustration, I could point this court to what we did expressly agree to. Every other dispute, you will recall, goes to litigation. In Section 7 of the MSA, we have agreed that all litigation will always be only Missouri on one side and the PMs on the other side. And I would say that it stands to reason that with that express agreement regarding litigation, it stands to reason we had the same intent for arbitration.
But if there was arbitration with single arbitration with 52 states, how do we prevent inconsistent results?
I think we're already doing it, Your Honor. I mean, if we didn't already know that there are 11 decision makers for the 04 arbitration, and we've already got at least 8 decision makers who are weighing in on the 03 dispute, we're already seeing that it can be done. I mean, if we were 5 years back, I think it would be more of a concern because we would be trying to predict what the future would look like. But we already know. We've got multiple decision makers for both the 03 and the 04 dispute, and PricewaterhouseCoopers is figuring out how to do the math. And so I think that is no longer a concern that should trouble us. I think we need to look simply at the language of the MSA and this court's own precedent and order this arbitration to occur the way Missouri requested it.
Any other questions? Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you.
We'll take a short recess. Case is submitted.